From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. Many people have left their churches or synagogues because of conflicts with traditional teachings. On today's Fresh Air, as we continue our series on religion and faith, we hear from two people who, rather than abandon their faiths, have worked to find new meaning there. Mary Jo Weaver discusses the dilemmas faced by feminists who are Catholic. And we'll discuss the Jewish Renewal Movement with Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine. He says he's trying to reclaim Judaism from the conservatives, the conformists, and the spiritually obtuse. Also today, comic Richard Belzer does his impression of Bob Dylan at his bar mitzvah. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has ordered Russian troops to finish disarming armed groups in Chechnya. He gave a long-awaited televised speech in Russia today. He defended the military siege in Chechnya, saying the separatist region is a grave threat to Russian stability. NPR's Ann Garrels reports from Moscow.
President Yeltsin ordered a halt to the bombing of Chechnya, but he remains adamant Chechnya remain part of Russia and, if necessary, force will continue to be used. Calling Chechnya a base for political extremism, terrorists, drug and arms traffickers, Yeltsin addressed the armed forces saying, "I call on you to do everything you can to restore order, and I believe you will do so." The only olive branch was the appointment of a negotiating team, but it's only charged with discussing the disarmament of Chechnya, and this is the same delegation Chechen leader Dudayev refused to meet a week ago. Yeltsin's explanations for the sudden military intervention in Chechnya are the first he's given publicly since he sent in troops more than 2 weeks ago, and they come amid growing opposition to the war and his presidency. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
A U.S. diplomat is on the Korean Peninsula on a mission to free a detained U.S. pilot. State Department envoy Thomas Hubbard is going to Pyongyang, hoping to free downed pilot Bobby Hall. Hall has been held by North Korea since December 17th, when his helicopter was downed in North Korean territory. His co-pilot, David Heilman, died in the crash. Washington continues to insist Hall and Heilman were on a routine training flight when they got lost and strayed into North Korean territory. The North insists the men were spying. A new kind of bullet is scheduled to go on sale next month. The makers call it rhino ammo and boast it causes large catastrophic wounds. One congressman calls it a cop killer and wants to ban it. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
These bullets are so deadly because they shatter into thousands of pieces of shrapnel when they hit the body. The fragments then slice through blood vessels and vital organs. The manufacturers say death is nearly instantaneous. The bullets are made for inexperienced gun users who might aim poorly when shooting in self-defense. But one version of the product is designed to penetrate bulletproof vests. That prompts Democratic Congressman Charles Schumer of New York to say he will introduce a bill next year to ban all types of cop killer bullets. Congress already bars armor-piercing bullets if they are made out of certain materials. That law does not cover this new ammunition. Schumer says bullets should be banned based on what they do, not how they are made. Some police organizations also oppose the new product. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 23 points at 3,856. The Nasdaq is up 3 at 745. This is NPR. A Mexican newspaper is reporting rebels have sabotaged dozens of airstrips in southern Mexico. The Mexican army charges the rebels have dug trenches and chopped down trees to block almost all of the 50 runways around Chiapas State. The army's responded by setting up roadblocks and camps around Chiapas and sending in hundreds of troops. Photographs show long lines of military vehicles and new checkpoints leading to the border with Guatemala. Italy's president has been talking with political leaders trying to resolve the political crisis following the resignation of Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. Several names are being circulated as his possible successor. The BBC's David Willey reports.
President Scalfaro met first with the speakers of the two houses of parliament. Carlos Cognamiglio, the speaker of the upper house, the Senate, who's been tipped as a possible successor to Mr. Berlusconi, said after his meeting with the president that this was one of the most complex and difficult political crises in recent years. On Wednesday, the president will begin 3 days of talks with leaders of all the main government and opposition parties, including, of course, Mr. Berlusconi himself. The television magnate favours early elections, as he puts it, to prevent the communists from coming to power. Italy's former communist party, the Democratic Party of the Left, on the other hand, wants a broad-based coalition to draw up an electoral reform law before Parliament's dissolved and due elections are held. Mr. Berlusconi's former coalition partners, the Northern League, who abandoned the government last week, are now split into two factions, one supporting Mr. Berlusconi and the other the former communists.
David Willey reporting. Administration officials say President Clinton has chosen Dan Glickman to replace outgoing Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy. Espy is leaving the Agriculture Department at the end of the year. Glickman has served 18 years in the House of Representatives for Kansas. He was defeated in November elections that swept Republicans into power for the first time in 40 years. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're featuring a series of interviews from our archives on religion and faith. Is it possible to be a feminist and a Catholic? How can you be faithful to your belief in equal rights while following a religion in which women cannot be ordained and cannot even use birth control? This is a question Mary Jo Weaver wrestles with. She is Catholic and a professor of religious studies and women's studies at Indiana University. Her book, New Catholic Women, examined how women were trying to change the patriarchal structure of the church. Her recent book, Springs of Water in a Dry Land, Spiritual Survival for Catholic Women Today, looked at women who are attempting to reform the church from within, and women who have left the church in despair and are seeking spiritual fulfillment elsewhere. Some of those who have left have gone to the other extreme and become goddess worshippers. Last year, I asked Weaver to explain why she's examining this form of neo-paganism.
I am most interested in the problem that women have with traditional religious formulations.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing. I mean, if you have a religious need or a religious consciousness, okay, you need community, you need some sense of ultimacy, you need a location where religion can operate, if we define religion as a means of ultimate transformation. So you've got certain kinds of religious needs and desires, and at the same time, you have feminist identifications or needs and desires in terms of autonomy and freedom and so on and so forth. When you look around and try to see how you would combine those things, how would you bring your feminist needs and your religious needs together, I think some women have felt that they can't do that in any kind of traditional setting, that the only way to do that is to leave all kinds of traditional religion behind, Christian, Jewish, Catholic, whatever, and to go off and to find or to refind, create or recreate what they see as the most ancient religion of all, and that is goddess religion, that the original divine figures were maternal. There have been several books arguing that, you know, these maternal, biophilic, peaceful societies existed in the ancient world. And so some women, I think, have been attracted to a religion for women or a religion with female divine figures. You're not going to find that in Judaism or the Catholic Church or traditional Christianity or Islam. So they go back to find it in goddess religion or what they think of as goddess religion.
How much of goddess worship do you think is based on rigorous history, and how much of it do you think is based more on wishful thinking or on a romantic view of the past?
The evidence that we have for these ancient matriarchies or for so-called goddess religion is pre-literate. That is, there are no texts. This is a kind of prehistorical moment. So people who are constructing or reconstructing goddess worship do it on the basis of pottery and sometimes on the basis of myths and legends and stuff like that. So its most vulnerable spot is its historical verification. It is not, in my opinion, a historical religion. Some critics have said it's a romantic recreation of the past. That might be. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, I think there's a prejudice that a religion can only be genuine or only be good for people if it's historically verifiable. I think it's possible for people to be religiously happy with something that's not historically verifiable. I think there's a way in which myths and poetry and things like that can help us to rethink where we are now. And I think that's good.
Have you been to goddess rituals or ceremonies? And I wonder what's moved you or struck you from those?
I have not been to. I do not find that an attractive option for myself. And as I say in this book, I taught a course here a few years ago, and in a sort of half-hearted attempt to bring in the goddess perspective, I think I had, you know, I did one reading or something like that, and I really think, I'd like to think of a way to put this on the air. I really blew it off in class. I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it. I just sort of indicated that a lot of people were critical of this. And I had four or five students that were, they were angry. A couple of them were in tears. And I'm trying to say to myself, what's going on here? What's going on here? And they were goddess worshipers, okay? I teach a course here on Christianity. I'm real sensitive to fundamentalist kids and to conservative Christians. And I know the sorts of things that upset them, and I don't tend to say that. But I think I wasn't prepared to see these goddess believers in my class. And because of that, and because of getting in conversations with them, I helped to put together a whole conference here at Indiana University on neo-paganism. And so I wrote that paper that's in my book on the goddess. But that is not out of personal desire. It was really an effort, I think, to be as fair as I could in looking at all the options that I could see.
Now, you've also written about women who are reinterpreting the religious text. Instead of forming like a new religion or going back to goddess worship, they're trying to just reinterpret the Bible and other religious texts to find more equality for women written within those texts? A better place for women?
It's kind of, you know, Mary Daly, I think, said a lot of years ago, if you took all the good parts of women out of the Bible and just put them into one little book, you'd have a pamphlet. it's hard to go back and take a book that has been shaped by cult and war and ritual and legalism that has purposely left women out and do much of a reinterpretation. On the other hand, critics like Phyllis Trible and people who work in biblical texts say that there's a lot more feminine imagery in the Bible than translators even allow for. You know, I mean, we're looking at a Bible in English because that's our language. When you go back and look up these words in Hebrew and so forth, apparently there's a lot more feminine resonance in some of those texts than we are led to believe. I'm still not sanguine about that as an option. I mean, I think we're probably, push comes to shove, going to find that this book is not particularly great for women.
What do you find most interesting on the revisionary front?
On the revisionary front right now, the most interesting book that's been written is a book by Elizabeth Johnson called She Who Is, arguing that we really have got that when the bottom line on all this stuff is the God symbol. And we have thought about God in exclusively male language and in masculine terms, king, warrior, lawgiver, he, him, and so on and so forth. Now, there are a group of people now who are arguing that that is a blasphemy, that really, if I can put it this way, gives God the short shrift, that basically metaphors about God are not God, they're just suggestions. We can never contain the divine in our language, and so we use our language to come up with what we think is the best approximation. And most language about God is anthropomorphic, that it's based on human experience and human symbols in some way. Well, the human symbols and human experience that have been exclusively used to talk about God are male or masculine. And so I think this argument would say what we want to do is to bring in symbols and experiences that are feminine, and that it's not good enough just to use the kind of language that never refers to God as he, using some kind of neutral language, but that in fact we really must refer to God as she and her will and so on, and him together, so that we come up with a much more balanced picture.
Do you ever think that it would be better to find some kind of neutral language to refer to God instead of he or she?
No.
God without gender? God transcending gender?
No, I don't really think so. Or, you know, as One of my graduate school professors used to say to me, when you're really in trouble, you don't say, oh, ground of my being, hasten to help me. You know, that these abstractions somehow take away from the central insight that we have about the deity, and that is that God has got a personality and is personally involved in our lives in one way or the other. And I think to constantly be referring to divinity, as I'm doing now, in these abstract kinds of terms rather than in more anthropomorphic language has got its own dangers.
Mm-hmm. Have you found a place for yourself within the church?
Myself? I find going to church sometimes profoundly uncomfortable. But that shouldn't be a huge problem. The language sometimes is bothersome to me, and sometimes it's not. I think I'm more bothered now by the fact that people seem to fiddle with the liturgy so much. It's very hard to, in my opinion at least, find a good liturgy that should waft you away and do certain things if you participate in it. Now I find it very kind of distracting. So my issues with the church are sometimes feminist, and they're sometimes really just more liturgical.
Well, you've described your own situation as one of spiritual homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't sure if you even go to church anymore.
Yes, I go to church. But I also am a kind of, I'm a pluralist person. I celebrate Passover with my surrogate family here, and I go to a lot of different churches. I go over to the AME church here two or three times a year. I go to the Catholic church. I think my connections with Catholicism probably are through, as it suggests in that book, through that kind of stream of religious experience that runs through what I think are the best parts of the Catholic mystical tradition.
How satisfying is it to go to services of different religions and different denominations as opposed to being affiliated with only one?
I feel affiliated with only one. Mm-hmm. That's not it. I mean, I think if you're my age and Catholic, it's probably hard to be anything else.
Yeah.
If you've I'm 50 years old, and being an ex-Catholic is probably not an option. And so I do not feel satisfied. I would not want to be anything besides what I am. I do, however, feel no constraints in terms of celebrating with other people in their traditions.
My guest is Mary Jo Weaver. She's a professor of religious studies and women's studies at Indiana University in Bloomington. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mary Jo Weaver. She's the author of Springs of Water in a Dry Land, Spiritual Survival for Catholic Women Today. Do you think that women have any hope of ordination within the Catholic Church?
No, I really don't. I keep trying. I gave the keynote address at the 10th anniversary of the Women's Ordination Conference, and my assessment of the historical situation then, which was 1985, remains the same. That is that women can stay in the church and wait to be ordained, and I don't see that happening in my lifetime. They can go to a Protestant church and be ordained and maybe not find a ministry. I don't know if they'll find that satisfying. Or they can basically try to respond to those communities that feel really still sacramental and in need of someone to celebrate with them and yet slightly off to the margins or askew or frankly, formally heretical to the Catholic Church and celebrate the Eucharist with them.
The most important woman in the imagery and symbolism of the Church is Mary. What are some of the controversies today over Mary's role in the Church?
I think, Mary, because we don't know anything about her really historically, except that she's the mother of Jesus. I mean, she's never mentioned by name in the New Testament, except in that context. And so where we don't know a lot, I think the imagination fills in. And I think the imagination fills in on the right and on the left as it has filled in through history. So in some sectors, Mary, I think, is a very conservative, if not reactionary, symbol. Various Marian apparitions, not just at Medjugorje in Europe, but also there are various Marian apparitions going on in this country right now, all over the United States at various sites. Most of the messages of those things are traditional and conservative. That is, Mary speaking against rock music, Mary speaking against abuses in the church, Mary speaking against abortion, and so on and so forth. On the other hand, I think on the left, you have people who will take a text like the Magnificat in the Gospel of Luke, "My soul proclaims the greatness of the Lord. My spirit rejoices in God my Savior. He has raised up the lowly from the earth, and he has cast down the mighty," as a kind of text of liberation theology or empowerment. Mary becomes a figure in some communities of the unwed mother, who was poor and a serving woman and kicked around and misunderstood and so on and so forth. So I think there's a whole sector there that can identify with her. I think there's a whole goddess motif around Mary, that a lot of the attributes of Mary in traditional Catholicism are rereadings or borrowings from certain kinds of things that we would find in the myth of Aphrodite or Venus or this or that or the other thing. I think in the traditional Catholic liturgy, there are all kinds of titles for Mary, you know, as Queen of Heaven and Tower of Ivory and Tower of David and things like that, that probably could be used, I think, to support Catholic women who are searching to find ways to maintain themselves and their feminism at the same time. So she's a very malleable, very plastic symbol, in my opinion.
You think of Jesus' attitude toward women as essentially positive and empowering. What have you found in the Bible that leads you to that conclusion?
Jesus treats women pretty much as equals. I mean, a normal man in Jerusalem at the time of Jesus probably shouldn't be speaking to women, should not be taking them particularly seriously, and should assume that they're going to sit home or stay home and cook and not do anything else. He's got these women followers. I mean, when he goes to the Samaritan woman, he goes and engages in a conversation with her that's kind of unheard of. He assumes that women are going to follow him or are going to be his disciples or are going to be empowering. If we look at a figure like Mary Magdalene, who has been used oftentimes by male interpreters is the figure of the prostitute or the hysteric, something like that. Let's look at that in a different way. I mean, what we have here is someone who's a friend of Jesus, the first person to whom he appeared. So in that way, the first of the apostles, someone who has got some clout and authority in the early church, it looks like, in one way, shape, or form. So I think there's a lot of positive things there.
What led you to studying theology as opposed to becoming trying to find a life within the church?
I did not study theology originally. I was a chemist, and I worked for a pharmaceutical chemical company for several years, and decided I did not want to do that forever. It was sort of an exalted way of being a cook, really, an organic chemist. So I wanted to go to graduate school, and this was right in the mid-60s when the council was just happening. I had always been interested in religion. I find the questions raised by religion in terms of culture and history and images and all those things fascinating. So I went back and got a PhD in theology after several years of working in a chemistry lab because I was interested in the questions. I've never been interested in any kind of professional life. I mean, I don't think I would want to be a priest, although I like preaching. I've done that a couple times, but I don't think I'm pastorally inclined. I like to teach, and I like to think, and I like to write.
Now, at what point did you also become interested in feminist issues, and what initial impact did that have on your religious studies?
I think if I had allowed myself to think much about feminist issues when I was a graduate student, I probably would have lost my mind. I was at Notre Dame, where I think there were 3 bathrooms for women on campus, and that's not a little teeny-weeny campus. And I just sort of went blissfully through that place, not thinking about it, and letting male professors say things like, well, we'll repeat this for Mary Jo, because she really hasn't had that much Latin, or stuff like that. I just didn't pay attention, period. And then my first job was in a seminary. I taught for 3 years in a seminary. And there, I think that atmosphere really was patriarchy at its finest, in all kinds of ways, insidious and kind of sugar-coated in various ways. I was quite in tune with that. Then when I came to Indiana University in 1975, people ask me how I could possibly be a feminist and a Catholic at the same time.
What would you say?
I would say I don't know, but I can do it. I think it can be done. That's what really led to my first book, New Catholic Women, having these conversations with people here who said, well, how do you hold that together? How do people hold it together? See, I think there's some assumption here, oftentimes by liberals, that religion is something you can just sort of fop off. You know, religion is a pain in the neck. Therefore, I won't have anything to do with it. I won't practice it. I don't think one can do that so easily. I mean, literature hasn't been great for women, but you just can't throw it over and say, well, that's it. There is no literature. History hasn't been great for women. You can't just throw it over. I don't think you can just throw over religion either. So I've been a lot more interested all the time in trying to see how you could make these things work together. And if it doesn't look like it can work together in the structure, then what can you do in your own life to enhance your religious life without selling out your feminist principles?
I know one of the women in Catholicism that has meant a lot to you is Teresa of Avila. I don't really know anything about her. Tell me something about her and what you've found in her story that resonates with you.
Teresa of Avila is a 16th century Spanish nun, a Carmelite, who probably led a jolly little life for a while and then had some kind of illness or something. I don't really know a whole lot about her person. I don't think much about her personal story. Her personal story doesn't interest me. She became a reformer, and she did all these kind of reforms in the Carmelite order. What's important about Teresa for me is that she, in her contemplative experience, she's a mystic and a contemplative. She's got a kind of prayer of quiet. In Teresa of Avila's prayer, in her understanding of God, God is located inside the self, at the deepest center of ourself, waiting for us to get in touch, as it were. And that we find God in ourselves by way of quiet prayer and contemplation. We don't have to be doing all these other kinds of things. And this God at the center of ourselves is passionately loving and affirming and cares about us and really is just longing for relationship with us, as we, in fact, should be longing for relationship with God. So that's Teresa's, I think, major insight is that God within us, and that's what's attracted me to it.
I guess that relates to what you were saying before, that you were interested in the mystical stream.
Yeah, that's it. That's been my way to sort of, if I don't agree with or find myself put in a quandary by what a particular bishop says, what the Pope says, and so forth, I think I find in contemplative prayer and in the mystical streams of Catholicism a retreat, a place to go, and a place to get myself refreshed.
Mary Jo Weaver is the author of Springs of Water in a Dry Land, Spiritual Survival for Catholic Women Today. She's a professor of religion and women's studies at Indiana University in Bloomington. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our series on religion and faith. Michael Lerner is the editor of Tikkun magazine. It offers a Jewish critique of politics, culture, and society. Recently, Lerner surveyed hundreds of Jews to understand why so many have virtually left their religion. Coming up, we talk with Lerner about the Jewish renewal movement, which is the subject of his new book. Also, a Yiddish punchline from comic Richard Belzer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're featuring a series of interviews from our archives on religion and faith. Michael Lerner is the editor of Tikkun, a magazine that offers a Jewish critique of politics, culture, and society. Lerner coined the expression the politics of meaning to describe an alternative to our current politics of greed, materialism, and self-promotion. Lerner says he is trying to reclaim Judaism from the conservatives, the conformists, and the spiritually obtuse. He continues that effort in his new book, Jewish Renewal. He's investigated why so many young Jewish people have virtually left their religion. He did a survey of over 350 people who drifted away from Judaism. Here's what he found.
Well, they told me that it had a great deal to do with the materialism that they experienced in the Jewish world, the lack of spirituality, the insensitivity, actually, to spiritual questions, the focus on selfishness, in this case, the selfishness of Jews focusing on their own survival without regard to the consequences for others. It was totally understandable, of course, given our history, why that would have happened, particularly after the Holocaust. But nevertheless, growing up in America, to be part of a community that seemed to only be asking the question of what was in Jewish interests was very hard for many people to take. Then there was the sexism and homophobia in the Jewish world. And there was a general sense that one's deepest spiritual issues were not being addressed. So ironically, people left the Jewish world not because it was too hard to be different from American society. That's what the Jewish establishment often says, is that Jews ran away because it's so hard to be Jewish. But actually, from my the information that I got in this survey, I found that people ran away because Jewish society was too much like American society. It had adopted too much of the materialism and the selfishness, the self-centeredness, the lack of spiritual sensitivity.
You were saying before that you found that a lot of young Jewish people tried to find spirituality in other religions because they didn't feel that they could find it in the Judaism that they were familiar with. You're part of what's called the Jewish Renewal Movement. Do you almost see that as a way of finding that spirituality in your own faith instead of looking elsewhere?
Absolutely. Judaism has a tremendous resources of spirituality, but those resources have been largely abandoned, in part by the trauma of Jewish history. It's hard to stay true to a God that is projected in the Bible that tells us that it's possible to fundamentally transform the world, change it to make it more ethically and spiritually alive. It's very hard to stay in contact with that God when bringing that message to the world has generated so much anger from ruling elites who have been furious that Jews keep saying that the world can be fundamentally transformed. Because they get furious at us, they have stirred up native populations against us all through our history. And as a result, Jews are a very disparaged and attacked group. So Jews want to run away from that. And yet there is in Torah and in the Jewish tradition a tremendous wealth of exciting spiritual insight.
I think a lot of people who were alienated from or disenchanted with their religion and have returned to it and seek a new, deeper spirituality there, are also often looking for new rituals or new prayers which communicate the way they see the world. And for a lot of people, it's because they feel that some of the old prayers were sexist or homophobic or whatever. But I'm wondering how you feel about new rituals and new prayers, whether you look more to the past or whether you're comfortable with creating new rituals to describe more contemporary sentiments.
I think we need both. There's an incredible amount of wisdom in the Jewish tradition, and I'm very reluctant to throw out that wisdom that's been built up over the course of 3,500 years simply because it doesn't immediately speak to us. And I think we have to reclaim within those traditions a great deal of that wisdom and find it there. And I have found it there, for example, in the way that the Sabbath is structured. With all of the rigid rules around the Sabbath, I've found it to be precisely because of the ways that it keeps us away from the rhythms of the rest of the week. It has created an incredibly deep spiritual space for me and for many other people. On the other hand, I also think that there are elements of the Jewish tradition that do embody sexism and homophobia, or an outdated view of God as a kind of patriarch sitting in heaven and dispensing good or evil depending on whether we please him, her. I don't think we can think of God in those terms, and I think we need new language and new ritual that can speak to our contemporary understandings.
So you use a combination of the two, the old rituals and new prayers.
Exactly. And I think that even when I sometimes reject older prayers, I think it's worthwhile to re-understand the mindsets that people were in previous historical moments, if only to be able to transcend them.
Tell us what your typical Sabbath is like now.
Well, it includes, first of all, 25 hours of exclusion from the world of work. I mean, no telephones, no writing, no using money, no buying and spending, no creating of anything connected with power over. The Sabbath is a unique moment to relate to the world, relate to the physical world from the standpoint of awe and wonder and celebration rather than from the standpoint of domination. So virtually everything that is connected with the power that we normally have over the world, I try to avoid. And instead join with other people on Friday night in a ritual meal, singing, storytelling, the next day with a prayer service in the morning, and again in the afternoon, a time to reflect, to read, often to commune with nature. Lots of good food, good sex are part of the tradition.
Good sex part of the Sabbath?
Yeah, it's actually an injunction for married people to have sex on Sabbath, because the Sabbath is not meant to be an affliction. It's meant to be pleasure.
What if you're not married?
There's no such injunction. You're not required to have sex.
You strike me as a pretty hardworking, achievement-oriented guy. You've got a magazine to put out. Say you're crashing on a deadline and it's the Sabbath. Will you ever violate any of your rules to save your magazine?
Well, I love Tikkun, and I think we're doing a great service to God by in the work of Tikkun, but absolutely not. In other words, it wouldn't be serving God to protect the magazine at the expense of undermining the sacredness of the Sabbath. The Sabbath is really a lifesaver for me, and I think for anyone who takes it seriously. For anybody who gets into those 25 hours in a serious way, it provides the spiritual nourishment that makes possible all the rest. So I absolutely don't do it, and when people frequently approach me in synagogue trying to hand me manuscripts to consider for the magazine, I say, not this Sabbath. I don't want to talk about the world of work. This is a moment for a different logic and a different way of being.
My guest is Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you.
My guest is Michael Lerner, author of the book Jewish Renewal.
You're both a very religious and a very political person, and those two come together for you in your life. In America, I think, you know, in the past few years, the most organized religious group in the political arena has been fundamentalists and the religious right. And I wonder what role you see for people who are more on the left like yourself and who are religious playing in the political world.
Well, I think it's very important for people with religious ideals to articulate those ideals in the political arena. I don't think that the problem with the religious right is that religion has no business being in the political arena. The problem with the religious right is that it's a religious vision that I think is offensive to anybody who recognizes that every human being is created in the image of God. And to the extent that that vision doesn't, it ought to be challenged. But there is a liberal notion that sort of says, if you allow any religion in there, you're never going to be able to stop the religious right. And so we should try to keep all of the religious views outside of the political realm. The problem with that view is that it fails to notice that the religious right is already in the political realm. And the people who don't have their religious or ethical values being argued for are the liberals and progressives. They think that they can keep the political arena neutral by refusing to argue for their highest ethical values in the political arena. But the result of that is not that the political arena stays ethically or religiously neutral. It's that the wrong people's ethical and religious views get articulated there, and nobody else gets a chance to articulate an alternative vision.
Although you disagree with the politics of the religious right, you've said that you want to really understand the legitimate needs that the religious right is addressing in America.
Exactly.
I wonder what conclusions you've reached about that.
Well, you see, from my standpoint, we live in a society which does not take the spiritual realm seriously. And people in their daily life find that their life is extremely frustrating because it's based so much on the principle of self-interest. In this context, where there's a huge spiritual crisis, the religious right comes forward and says, hey, we need a different set of values. We need values that value human beings, that value relationship, that value commitment, that value spirituality. And I think that they are right to a great extent in noticing that this is a big problem. The only problem is that they then come forward with a spiritual or ethical view that demeans somebody else, that blames these problems on some demeanable other, whether that be blacks or gays or feminists or liberals, but they are articulating a real problem. And I think that this is the great problem for the liberals, is that they don't understand that when people are moving to the right, they're often moving to the right for legitimate needs, for a legitimate desire for some kind of ethical and spiritual worldview that the liberals think is inappropriate for politics.
I have one last question for you. Were your parents really surprised when you so fully embraced Judaism?
Well, at first they were very astounded. They thought that when I had first decided to get into it, they thought this was a really lower middle class thing to do. It was downwardly mobile.
Why would it be downwardly mobile?
Well, because if you wanted to make it an American society, you had to put your own self-interest first and not some values first. And you weren't going to make it that way. If you were going to be wealthy, you were not going to let Shabbos interfere. You certainly were not going to start talking about redistribution of wealth. You know, the Torah has this principle that every 50 years, all land gets redistributed back to an original equal redistribution. Well, talking about that sounded in the 1950s and 1960s as though this were communism, or this was some terrible political idea that would totally undermine your ability to have any credibility in American politics or American society. So the Torah has a lot of revolutionary ideas in it, and you really undermine your credibility as a political force or as an economic force if you took them seriously. But then again, Torah wasn't meant to be a guide for how to make it in American society. It was meant to be a guide for how to transform the world according to a higher view, according to a divine view of what the world could be.
But let's get back to your parents. So they were surprised.
They were very surprised, yes. And at first disappointed, and then at a later point delighted.
Disappointed because?
Disappointed because they had hoped that I would be a greater achiever, say, in the society, that I would make it more than they had. My father and mother had imagined that I was going to be a U.S. senator, the first Jewish U.S. senator from New Jersey. That was their fantasy, and it was very disappointing to them when I lost interest in political power and was more interested in articulating an ethical and spiritual view.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Michael Lerner is the editor of Tikkun magazine and author of the book Jewish Renewal. Our interview was recorded in September. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll have this story. Boris Yeltsin speaks to the people of Russia about his policy in attacking the Chechen capital. Nina Totenberg has a report on the progress of civil rights in the Clinton administration. Robert Siegel talks with the theater critic of the London Times about the playwright John Osborne, who has just passed away. John Nielsen reports on ideas to cut expenses for the various national parks in this country. And I'll talk with one of the rangers from Denali National Park in Alaska. They want to start charging the climbers there to climb Denali $150. That does not answer the big question. What about the average rescue cost of $7,500?
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week we're featuring a religion series on our show. Let's face it, the subject of religion doesn't always lead to reflection. Sometimes it leads to comedy. Richard Belzer is a comic who now co-stars in the NBC cop series Homicide. I spoke with him in 1987, and every time the subject of being Jewish came up, he broke me up. Let's start with a story of how he was discharged from the Army during the Vietnam War.
I got out of the Army by feigning mental illness, if you will. I pretended that I was suicidal, and I staged this whole thing where I said I got beat up and my back was hurting, and they found out I was faking, and they sent me to the Jewish chaplain in the Army. I didn't know there were Jewish chaplains. I thought Pat O'Brien was the... I didn't know Jews joined the Army. I didn't know Jews were, let alone chaplains, and I went to this rabbi, and I said, Rabbi, because my sergeant said that you got to go see your chaplain, Belzer, because you need help. So... I went to the chaplain. I said, Chaplain, with all due respect, I think I need to see a psychiatrist. And he said, you know, Freud was a Jew. And the reason he became a psychiatrist was to discover his Jewishness. You don't need a psychiatrist. You need to discover why you're a Jew. And he lectured me on kosher food and choirs and how I could sing in the Army Jewish choir and eat kosher food. And I said, really, Rabbi, I need to see a psychiatrist. He said, you have to discuss. Do you have a girlfriend? I said, no. He said, did you ever have? I said, yeah. Was she Jewish? Good. Like, everything was revolved around Judaism, which was the farthest thing from my mind. And I just wanted to get out of the Army. Finally, I was allowed to go to the psychiatrist. And I, having had a little college, I knew every freshman psychology phobia. So I said that I went to bed. I was suicidal. I hated my mother. I was afraid of women. I just did every cliche in psychology, and I got out.
Did you ever think to yourself, what happens if I'm discovered that this is just an act?
What's that?
When you were trying to get out of the Army and faking
all
this stuff.
Well, I think that it's kind of like partially, they knew that I was acting crazy, but I was crazy to do that in the first. It was kind of like that, It was like,
right, if you could do this so well, who wants you around
exactly.
Anyways?
Exactly, it was like Kafka meets Catch-22 or something.
No, you were talking about the chaplain in the Army who lectured you about...
Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, who lectured you about Judaism. I think the very first time I saw you perform was on Saturday Night Live, and you were doing your impression of Bob Dylan in like a retirement center singing in a Yiddish accent.
Right, well, the 86-year-old Bob Dylan.
Yeah. Now, I hate to ask questions like,
sure.
How did that idea come to you? But really, how did that idea come to you?
Well, when I was a kid, I hate to say that Bob is that much older than me, but when I was a teenager, and we started first getting into Bob Dylan, And we found out his real name is Zimmerman, and he's a Jew from Minnesota, and this was like a revelation to have a hero that's a Jew. So I said, if his name is Zimmerman, he must have had a bar mitzvah. So I fantasized what Bob Dylan's bar mitzvah must have been like, you know. Baruch atadonai Eloheinu melech olam asher kiddushanu b'mitzvosav. And then he gets older, you know. Oi, oi, once upon a time, you dressed so fine, you threw the bums a dime in your prime, didn't you? People called Shady Red Doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they was all kidding you. And so on.
Oh, who spoke Yiddish in your family?
Actually, I just got back into Yiddish music. I've discovered these things. Everyone in my family spoke Yiddish, but I resent the fact that they didn't share, they didn't teach me, they didn't teach my brother or my cousins. My parents would talk in Yiddish, my grandparents would talk in Yiddish, and there's a comedian who does a routine, I can't think of who it is, but where it's true, if I may borrow the routine without crediting the person. And that is that Jewish families had the habit, the adults would tell a joke. They'd be telling a joke in English, and then a kid would walk in the room, and then they do the punchline in Yiddish. They say, so the guy walks up to the maid, he opens the door, he sees that she has no clothes on, and then a kid walks in the room, and he goes, Achel of a shin v'chel of a cha! And you don't know what the punch... It was the most frustrating thing I've ever... I still resent my uncles to this day for doing that to me. And I wish I could remember the comedian that did that. Maybe it was Robert Klein, but... That's not my routine, but it's a true story.
You know, since it was the older people in your family who spoke Yiddish, did you think that when you grew up, you'd automatically know the language?
That's funny, because I have a theory that everyone, when they get old, no matter what religion they are, they have a Jewish accent. Even Irish people, they get to be past 65. I want to go to the store now, because I'm in the store, good, because I can't, hello? You know, everyone, Italians, everybody, they, for some reason, they get a Jewish accent.
Comic and actor Richard Belzer, recorded in 1987. Our religion series continues tomorrow. Let's close today's Fresh Air with the Microscopic Septet and their recording of the waltz of the recently punished Catholic schoolboys. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our series on religion and faith. Religion scholar Martin Marty discusses the history of fundamentalism. And writer Terry Tempest Williams, who is a Mormon, discusses what happens when her faith and politics are at odds. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.